Investing Simplified is brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm with Bo Caldwell, CFP, and Chuck Price, founder and author of Investing Simplified, the book, and the number one bestseller, Your Retirement Made Simple. Chuck Price has been doing estate planning since 1970 and investing in retirement planning since 1975. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. Investing Simplified is the longest-running live financial show in America with a financial advisor and now a CFP, an estate planning attorney, and a CPA to answer your questions for free, and comes to you live from Portland, Oregon on affiliated stations throughout the Pacific Northwest. You can contact Bo or Chuck by visiting pfgwm.com. Or you can email them with a question at ask@pfgwm.com. Or you can call them right now at 503-417-9595. That's 503-417-9595. And for our long distance and podcast listeners, you can call toll free at 877-733-1011. That's 877-733-1011. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Bo Caldwell.
Welcome into Investing Simplified. However you're listening today, thank you for making us a part of your day. Just a reminder, we do rebroadcast this show on podcasts, Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Google Play, wherever you get your podcast selections. I want to start the show today by apologizing a little bit for our technical difficulties last week. We had some technical difficulties to open the show. I think we're going to have a smooth show this week, but I think we're good to go. So give us a call, 503-417-9595. If you have a question that's been keeping you up at night, now's the time to pick up the phone and ask. We've got our experts here in-house. I'm Bo Caldwell. Good morning. Thank you for listening. We have Kevin Stege here in studio from Baker Coulson. Hello, Kevin.
Howdy, Bo.
And we also have Michael Standard from Fairway Mortgage in here. Hello, Michael.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here, and thanks for listening. Like I said, we're going to answer some tax questions today. We're going to answer some real estate questions, some mortgage, some investments in real estate, those sort of questions. But if you have something specifically that's been keeping you up at night, something that has been bothering you, you've been wondering, pick up that phone, give us a call. If you're not local here in Portland, you can also call at 877-733-1011 or visit investingsimplifiedradio.com to ask your question there, which basically behooves the question. We had a question come in last week that we covered at the beginning of the show, but because of our difficulties, I don't think it went out. So just to go over again, kind of a little bit about that Roth conversion question. So we had a question about converting funds from an IRA to an existing Roth and how to withhold the taxes. One of the options that you can do, it may or may not be the best option, but you can actually withhold the taxes from your conversion, from the actual conversion dollars. So if you were to convert $10,000, you're in the 22% tax bracket, right? So that means you have a $2,200 tax bill. You could conceivably withhold or prepay that $2,200 from the conversion. I'd prefer if you had it outside, so that way we can keep the qualified dollars, the retirement dollars inside the accounts. But that is an option for you to do that. And just a reminder, we talked about last week, I asked specifically Kevin his rule of thumb for how much money is a good idea to convert to Roth. Just a general rule, this is not a blanket statement for everyone. Consult with your individual tax preparer, your individual tax professional. But as if you're in that 12% bracket and we can get you up right up underneath that 22% bracket, that's the amount to use.
That's right. Yep. And that for a dollar amount is for a married couple, it's taxable income after your deductions. It's taxable income of roughly around $75,000, $80,000 for a single person. It's half of that. So 35, it's like 38,000 or something. So that's kind of what we're looking for. Keep you under that of taxable income.
Right. And which again is a rule of thumb. So yeah, make sure you consult your professional. If you'd like to consult our professional, Kevin is available to talk about that and he helps people with that all the time. So give him a shout. Kevin, we also have another tax question that had come in that has, the question comes, it says, I plan to sell my house in Oregon and move to Vancouver, Washington, a common theme, right?
Yep. Yep.
And buy a condo there to establish residency. I will register my cars, get a Washington driver's license, and register to vote in Washington. Do I need to do anything else to show that I am no longer a resident of Oregon for tax purposes? Do you have a checklist of steps to take based on clients who have successfully moved from Oregon to Washington?
Oh, that's a very good question. No, we don't have a checklist. It's all a facts and circumstances thing. So, I mean, you've covered the main ones right there. I think one time I heard somebody failed their residency change. They had some other issues, but one of the things way down the list that was looked at was where were they doing their shopping? Of course, they still maintained a residence in Oregon. Mm-hmm. They were kind of playing a shell game, and they probably deserved to fail. You know, if you've sold out of Oregon and your only residence is Washington, and you know you've changed your voter card and car registrations, you're good to go.
Even if I'm still coming across to Cascade Station to buy my major purchases, if I'm going to go buy my 4K TV to watch the Oregon Ducks play, because that's who I watch, right? So if I'm going to buy my 4K TV at Best Buy, that's still okay because I'm avoiding the sales tax by doing that, right? That's the plan.
I don't get involved in that type of what you do on your personal time. However, watching the Ducks is a good thing, so right. I would grant you exemption right there.
You support right. that? I like that.
Yes.
I like that.
Yes. Well,
you know, Chuck's not here today, so yeah. we can't give him a hard time about yeah. you know because he gets squirmy when we start being all super homer for the Ducks
because he's a Husky. Exactly. The rule is if you're a Washington resident and you're buying big ticket items that you're not paying sales tax on, you are supposed to file a use tax return and report that sales tax and pay it. So it's part of our voluntary tax system, and that's how the rules are set up.
I like that.
Yep.
Well, I mean, I don't like having to pay extra taxes, but
that's
I like
right.
that answer.
That's right.
That's good.
Voluntary tax?
You voluntarily file until they show up with handcuffs.
voluntary until they make it involuntary.
Exactly.
And say, yeah, right. Al Capone would argue that it's not a voluntary tax, or he would have, I suppose. Right. So the other thing I wanted to talk a little bit about to start, but besides the Roth conversion and the tax question that had come in from the text line. So if you do have a question, give us a shout, give us a question on the text line. But it's just the way that the market has been behaving lately. I've gotten a lot of questions from people about when's the right time to buy, when's the right time to get in, or is it time to get out and sell? And the long and the short answer is yes to everything, right? It's or now. if you're a long-term investor, this volatility that's been happening over the last few months really is it's a return to normal. That's something that we just haven't really seen in the last couple of years, but other than the end of last year, but it is a good thing. Big swings in the market are good for you if you are a long-term investor, because when the market's down, that means you're on sale. And hypothetically, if you're 35, 40, 45 years old right now, and you've got, you know, 30 to 40 years till you're allowed to touch that retirement money, you should be putting more money into your 401k or your 403b if you can. If you can, you know, deduct more money out of your paycheck, if you're not participating in your 401k or 403b right now and your company has a match, that is a giant mistake. That's a blanket statement I can make to everybody, that you need to take advantage of that free money. So if they're doing a match, that's money that you can never get back. And most companies here around town, the big companies at least, are providing that match. And that could be in a simple IRA if you're work for a small family-owned business. They can offer that simple IRA. And then Oregon has the Oregon Saves program, which is started for businesses over a certain amount. That's a Roth program, but that's a great program to use because you're putting money away. And the big benefit of the 401k and the 403b, besides that free money, which free money is nice, right? But is the out of sight, out of mind factor of it. So if you're pulling it out of your paycheck, it's going into that retirement account before you ever see it. Because a lot of people say, well, I'm going to save up money and put it in savings, and then I'll do that IRA contribution before April 15th because my CPA said I have until then to do it, right? But the problem is then you have to go to Best Buy to get, you know, to get some headphones, and then that TV that we just talked
4K,
about,
yeah,
that
TV.
4K TV screams yep. at you, and you yep. say, well, I can't really afford it. Oh, but wait, I have this money set aside. Or for those people who are not spendthrifts and aren't going to just spend money, you know, because burning a hole in their pocket, although that's pretty normal, is an emergency that comes up or some sort of pseudo emergency, and then so you end up spending that money. If it's out of sight, out of mind, you've learned to live with the amount of money that's hitting your paycheck. So if it's already coming out of your before you get that money into your bank account, then you don't even think about using it. And I would suggest making sure that you're doing that and then thinking about increasing it. A really effective strategy that I've used with folks that come in that are saving money in their 401k or just getting started is start with an amount that you know you can do, and then have it automatically increase by 1% every year. Because then you don't really notice it, right? And you probably are getting a pay raise. Most places will give you a cost of living increase in your pay. And if you're automatically increasing your pay, you need to automatically increase your contribution to retirement. There's a terrifying statistic that bounces around, and depending on who you read it from, U.S. World News Reports or Barron's or all these different financial companies that do this research, we are woefully underprepared for retirement in this country. And there is a significant amount of folks, and like I said, depending on the company that quotes it, that have less than $1,000 saved for retirement. To me, that's the most terrifying thing that you know you could have, in terms of, because you can't work forever. You can continue working, but at some point you're not going to be able to work anymore. I don't know if you're, you know, if you're younger than 55 years old right now, I don't know what Social Security is going to look like when you get to the point where you can take Social Security. I'm not saying it's not going to be there. I'm not saying that it's not going to pay out. We've paid into it. It's money that we've paid into, right? But I don't know what form it's going to take, how long you're going to have to wait for it. And even if Social Security stays the same as it is right now, for most people, just taking your Social Security is not enough money to live on. It's not enough money it's certainly not enough money to have the same lifestyle that you have now, but it's definitely not enough money to live on. So if you haven't had an adequate plan, if you haven't started that plan, it doesn't matter where you are, give my office a call, 503-253-3000, or send me an email, bo@pfgwm.com. I'd love to sit down with you, talk to you about getting you on track for retirement planning. And that's a no obligation thing. We don't charge people for those meetings. We don't charge people to get you a basic financial plan going. We're trying to get that information out there for folks.
Yeah. You know, if you're a younger investor, worker, what have you, it's usually a pretty dicey time. You know, you're trying to pay off college loans. You're maybe trying to get a mortgage into your first house. There's a lot of pulls on your money. And when it comes to saving or retirement, you know, with that 3% or 3% match, it's sometimes 3%, maybe 6%, whatever your 401k match is from your employer, that you do what you have to do to make your contribution to get the maximum match from your employer. And if it means cutting the size of your meals down, if it means going to a different cell phone plan, going without your cable TV or maybe whatever you have for stuff, that's one of the places you want to focus on making sure you can do that. That's going to it's money in the bank. It's good as gold. And a lot of people don't have that option with their employer. So if right. you do, really focus on that. I mean, we can all afford to lose some weight. So cut your meals down to make that one work for a year or two.
Why are you looking right at me when you're talking about
40? I was staring off in the distance.
Michael, he was looking right at me.
I was. Hey.
It's okay. If the shoe fits, it's
all
fine.
Right.
I'm hurt, but it's tough, but fair.
Okay.
Right? So with that, we're going to take our first break and we'll come back with the tax investigator after. Thank you for listening. Thank you for tuning in. Stay with us and we'll be right back to answer your questions. You're listening to Investing Simplified.
Are you concerned about your retirement income? Do you really understand how your Social Security benefits work? Price Financial Group Wealth Management has helped many seniors in Oregon and Washington maximize their Social Security benefits at retirement through using their Social Security seminar on demand. Now you can watch this valuable information in the comfort of your home by just going to www.pfgwm.com and click on the free Social Security kit. If you are serious about your retirement planning, you cannot afford to miss this opportunity. After all, you have invested your hard-earned dollars into Social Security all your working years. So shouldn't you get the maximum return you can get from those dollars? The future can be scary, and without a plan, it can be even scarier, especially when facing the unknown. What you don't know can hurt you. Get your free Social Security kit at pfgwm.com or call 503-253-3000.
Here's your opportunity to ask Kevin Stege, CPA and shareholder of the Baker Colson CPA firm, that tax question that's been keeping you up at night. You can call Kevin, 503-417-9595, or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's the CPA with the tax answers, Kevin Stege.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified, and we do want your questions. Phones are open, 503-417-9595 or 877-733-1011. And today, this could be a kind of a fun segment here. We're going to review a number of court cases or maybe changes to code sections over the last year. And we're going to do a kind of a surface level look at a number of these things. Hopefully what we'll do is we'll kind of give you an idea of what the taxpayer was attempting, what the rules say under the code section that they were that's concerned, and then whether they won or failed. And most of these are fails, and we all like to watch somebody else's shipwreck, just so long as it's not our own, right? So we'll get right into it. And so this first one here is the Doyle case, and it was a taxpayer that received a settlement from his employer for wrongful discharge. So he was fired for whatever reason. He won the court case. He got a nice settlement check. And so the taxpayer attempted to claim that this income was non-taxable. And there is a code section that may allow that. And code section 104 basically says when there's physical sickness or physical injury, those types of settlements are non-taxable. Anything other than that, it can be, you know, there's multiple reasons for settlements. But unless they're specifically for physical sickness or physical injury, they need to be reported as income and you need to pay taxes. Unfortunately for this taxpayer, in the settlement agreement, it says that the settlement was for emotional distress damages for his wrongful termination. And interestingly enough, under Code Section 104, there's a statement that also says that emotional distress shall not be treated as physical injury or sickness. So the taxpayer clearly had no foot to stand on. His situation was clearly addressed in the code, just took a bad position and was caught and paid the taxes and, of course, the late penalty and the interest.
The interest that it accrued from, and that's a key that I learned, not, I don't want to call it the hard way because it wasn't the hard way, but I learned later on not knowing that the interest accrues from April 15th, right?
That's
not
right.
From you. So if you're a corporation that's filing later, if you filed extensions or any of that sort of stuff, the interest is still accruing. Whether you're not late, maybe not paying penalties, but you're paying interest.
That's right. And even if you amend a return for like 2-3 years back, the interest is calculated from April 15th of the due date of that tax return. So that's it can add up at 3%, 4%, or 5%. I think we're up to 5% now on interest.
Interestingly enough, because I don't have to, the government doesn't pay me to, you know, for them to borrow my money at 5%.
That's true. They do, but it is a little more favorable on their end about when those are calculated and stuff. And there's some talk about making the interest calculations exactly equal, and it kind of makes sense. But, you know, hey, there's reasons for everything. So,
right.
Okay, our next case. This is one that we in the tax industry have, at least I have, followed for a number of years, and it's related to the housing allowance exemption for ministers.
Okay.
And this was this housing allowance exemption. Basically, the rules in place say a minister is making $60,000, and the parsonage is $20,000 a year to run. Instead of receiving $60,000 of taxable compensation, he can receive $40,000. 20 of it can be designated as a housing allowance. That 20 is tax-free. And so a group of folks said, hey, that's not fair. You're favoring ministers over other people, and it violates the Establishment Clause of the Constitution of promoting a religion. So this went to court. They found a district, we won't say which one, who ruled in this group's favor and said, housing allowances are unconstitutional, and we want to get rid of it. Well, it finally went up to through appeals, and they established that. And I will say, in the Establishment Clause, there's a three-part test. that says a statute must have a secular purpose. It cannot advance or inhibit religion, and it cannot foster excessive government entanglement with a religion. So that's the current establishment clause. And the tax court actually reversed this decision and said, no, the housing allowance is fair. And they gave all sorts of other reasons. But for me, the main one was, is this, you may not know it, but this actually just treats ministers the same as any other employee or employer out there, because there is a whole section that allows employers to provide tax-free housing to employees if it meets certain circumstances, and these are the exact circumstances. So I think the tax court got this one right. It just makes an even playing field. The group is not going to appeal. They said the courts are too political, but frankly, they don't need to appeal because they're going to lose. It's pretty right. well spelled out.
That makes sense. And so when you said that, just to review, that's an allowance on, say, minister makes $60,000 and he's spending, or I should say, or she, the minister is spending the $20,000 on the housing, and so they get $20,000 off. Well, how does that work? And this is sort of off the cuff, so if you don't know the answer to it, but
I do know it.
You have all of the answers. That's the new nickname is Matt. Maybe you're the tax oracle now. Oracle. If my minister is getting that $60,000, but my parish pays for the housing that, you know, outside of that, is that work the same way where, hey, we have $20,000 that we're paying for the housing? Is that untaxable income at that point, or is that where you get into the weeds?
Well, typically what you see to make this work is the minister pays for the housing. And say they say at the beginning of the year, hey, my housing costs $20,000. So they designate $20,000 of his salary tax free. Then when the minister goes and does their tax return, when it hits our desk, say their costs were only $15,000, the minister would actually report $5,000 more as taxable.
Oh, okay.
So ministers' taxes are pretty complicated, and they end up many times paying more taxes with that housing allowance because they're subject to the both sides of self-employment tax on that.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So it's a complicated area. Okay, next court case. And we see this fairly often where a taxpayer has a disabled adult child in their home that they're still taking care of. And this may be, say somebody with Down syndrome, or maybe severe, physical disabilities. But under certain circumstances, when this is a ongoing condition, there's Medicaid payments to the taxpayer that are tax-free to take care of this disabled adult child. And I think it's a good program. I think it's a good thing, because who's going to take care of that person better than their parents?
Yeah.
And we can help them out by making that tax-free. I think that's one of the great things about our country, is we do take care of those who can't take care of themselves.
Amen.
And but this court case is the taxpayer properly excluded it from income, but by excluding it from earned income, they didn't get baseline earned income to calculate the earned income credit.
Oh, sure.
Well, which is a very nice credit, and it's refundable. And so the taxpayer actually factored in it in as earned income and then claimed the credit. And that's typically what you have to do to get it to be challenged and go to court. And the tax court basically upheld that position and said, it is, even though it's excludable for income tax purposes, it's still part of the earned income credit calculation, and they found in favor of the taxpayer. So
what you're saying is occasionally the tax court finds in favor of the taxpayer.
That's
They're not always against you.
That's right. There's a lot of gray areas out there, and sometimes you just got to toe the line and see what happens. Okay, so here's another one. I'm going to skip this one. That one's only a case an accountant could love. But let's bore our listeners. They'll all hang up if I go into that one. S Corp 2% shareholders. Okay, so here's a good one. So here's a case, the Langston case. The taxpayer lived in a house for about 10 years, and they decided to start renovating it significantly. And so they lived in it from 1997 to 2005. They begin renovating it in 2001. The renovations weren't complete until 2010. This is a mess, obviously. And they began renting it to a friend at below fair market value in 2012 to help keep their insurance coverage on the place. And then they sold it in 2013, former personal residence, and they claimed a almost $500,000 loss on this asset. And as we all know, you can't deduct personal losses, but you can deduct business or investment losses. And the tax court found against the taxpayer, saying you did not properly convert it from a personal asset to a business or an investment asset. It wasn't properly rented out. There was no real business reason to do it. And so, a lot of these things are facts and circumstances, and there's nothing wrong with converting it, but they needed to rent it out at fair market value, properly report it.
Right. They report it as a business, right? They have rental income as a business, not as...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly right. So that was kind of an interesting one. Well, here's one that gives us some rules that affects us all. Is your activity engaged in for profit? Is this a hobby or is this business? And we have two to look at. This first one is with a historical aircraft, and this taxpayer purchased a Firefly, a rare British long-range reconnaissance fighter plane used in World War II. And So he purchases this for, it was 60% restored, and he buys it for $200,000. He spends several years actually creating some of his own parts because they weren't even available anymore to finish the renovations. And he flies this at air shows. It's on the front of a number of magazines. So a pretty significant asset that's out there. And he, for 3 years, he decides to start taking the business losses on this and take some pretty significant depreciation. And the tax court said... a couple interesting things is he's the only one certified in the world to fly this plane, special certification. So, I mean, he's taken it to air shows. This is his thing. The problem comes in is he's taken huge losses and he's only bringing in about $10,000 of income a year. So he clearly doesn't have a business plan. The income doesn't even cover his insurance costs on this. And so he had a lack of a formal business plan. He didn't keep separate financial books. He actually claimed on real estate tax exemption forms where he got exempt on real estate taxes on this, that this was not a commercial endeavor. So he kind of shot himself in the foot there.
Yeah.
And so as you can see, that failed. The tax court said, no, you find an extreme amount of pleasure flying this around the country and the notoriety. So this unfortunately didn't pan out. And we'll take a look at one other hobby loss. And
this fishing, salmon fishing?
Pretty close. This is close. This is a yacht. This is a yacht. We can all live vicariously through this case. So this is a taxpayer that bought a $4.5 million yacht. He's a CEO of a company.
As you do. I mean, that's a weekend for you, right?
Yeah, that's right. Here's where... He said, this is where it separates from me. You know, the $4.5 million, maybe that could happen in my dreams. He put $10 million in renovations in this.
Whoa.
Yeah. So he takes his 155-foot yacht. He has a full-time staff that the monthly payroll is $25,000, and he uses it personally for a number of years just fine. That's what you do. But he decides right after the downturn in like 2010, hey, I'm going to rent this out and make some money on it. And he only chartered it one time for $150,000. And he claimed, and then he sells the yacht. And so he wants to claim this $10 million loss and all of these other losses. And he got nipped in the bud again. He didn't have... A business plan. He didn't conduct it in a business-like manner. This one I find interesting. The tax reporting was unbusiness-like, the tax court said. His CPA told him, you have to take depreciation because it's a business asset, he didn't want to because, quote, he would have depreciation recapture.
Right.
Well, you can't do that. So anyway, so this guy fails too. So with that, we have other cases, but we'll leave it at that and go to our break, and we'll be back with Investing Simplified.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Colson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Colson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We're located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercolson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercolson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Colson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
It's now time for the Mortgage Makeover with Michael Standard of Fairway Mortgage, NMLS number 1674259. Have a mortgage question? Call now at 503-417-9595. Now, here's Michael Standard.
Good morning, everybody. As you're probably well aware, the 30-year fixed rate rose from up to 3.87 from 3.74, so 13 basis points. Our 15-year is up to 3.22 from 3.11. Aren't those amazing rates?
Yeah, I was like, they're up, but that's still significantly down. That's, you know, still, what's that, you know, 13 basis points off a historical low,
yeah,
right?
3.87 on average in the nation. That is really low. And we still have down payment assistance programs out there for all of the first-time home buyers, 4%, 3.5%, sometimes as high as 5%, both in Oregon and Washington. Great opportunities for the new buyers to try to get into the market, capture a home, and build some equity. Also, we have the Feds coming on. At the end of the month, they're going to be also lowering rates again, we assume, by quarter basis point. I believe we've already priced that in, so rates I don't think are going to go much lower.
Okay. That's a question I get a lot, is if they do lower the Fed lowers the short-term interest rate, that is that going to translate to mortgages? And you said probably not. We think it's
probably not. I think we've already priced it in, but you never know.
Right.
You never know. And, you know, we've got the currency wars happening right now, and we've got other political issues that are driving the markets up and down, and we're pricing differently every day. They're not real stable right now.
Sure.
Rates are going up and rates are going down. It's just a matter of finding that right home with a good realtor and getting it done. I'm also experiencing a lot of seniors downsizing. We've got a lot of new builders, our older builders who are building ranch homes, and they're getting blown up. They are having people come in and they're having bidding wars on them, in fact, on new construction.
And it's new construction on those, on the single level living, mm-hmm, ranch homes. Have you seen a lot of, because I know, you know, at least, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, and particularly before that, you know, the housing market issues in 2007, 2008, but that they were buying up those ranch homes that were built in the 60s and 70s and knocking them down and putting two large, you know, my mother calls them McMansions, right? But the two large homes on the same property that had one ranch home. But are you seeing more ranch home, kind of, I don't want to call it a callback to a simpler time. No, but a little more, maybe some more space, but having the ranch home and not pushing them all together, or is it still kind of?
I think they're still on small lots because land is really expensive right now. It's not cheap, but we have an influx of seniors. As you're well aware, mm-hmm, there's 10,000 seniors a day turning 62, qualifying to become a senior citizen. That's 10,000 turning 70. That's a lot of people who are needing to downsize, and we're seeing them not wait anymore.
Right.
We know that the market's pretty good. We know the pricing is pretty good out there. So if they're purchasing it with a mortgage, they're getting in now because it's a good time. If they're doing them with the HECM purchase program, the home equity conversion mortgage program, we're still seeing a lot of them liking that program because they're saving 45% of their equity from, mm-hmm, their old home they sold, rolling over only 55%. So they're putting a lot of cash in their pockets. And it's making them pretty happy because we're also seeing a lot of seniors out there just feeling stuck. stuck. They have a $300,000, $400,000 home. It's nice. Their knees hurt. You know, the stairs are killing them. Their back hurts. The yard's too big. But now they're taking advantage of some of these new construction homes that are somewhat affordable, between $400,000 and $600,000 out there. And they're flying off the shelves right now.
Which is a good thing if you're selling, maybe not a good thing if you're buying them, if they're flying off the shelves, right? But
Yeah. Can
you talk to a little bit more about, I've had that question come up a couple of times, you know, if someone is looking to downsize or if they're just looking to move, so in that situation, so my house is worth about $350,000, mm-hmm. But I'm tired of living there, I'm tired of the stairs, I'm looking for single level living, maybe move a little bit closer to the kids or grandkids, move, you know, have a place that I can, you know, that I can age in, you know, that's not going to be a problem getting upstairs or just smaller house, right?
Right.
But if I'm going to go from my $350,000 house and try to buy a $400,000 or $500,000 new construction house, that can be kind of a problem if I don't have income, right? Because they have to use asset dissipation or different things like that. Right. So you talk a little bit more about strategies that people use?
Certainly. One of the programs out there is home equity conversion mortgage, of course, which is the old reverse mortgage turned into the new revamped product as of 2017. With that program, they could sell that $350,000 home. Of course, they can't usually qualify for a regular mortgage because they don't have enough income.
Right.
That income ratio would be too high. Instead of putting all their cash, finding another $350,000 home, they're finding a $500,000 home and putting down basically $275,000, saving that other $75,000 in the bank or investing it for future issues. And we all know the future issue is nursing care.
Sure.
And a lot of them cannot afford nursing care policies, long-term care. We'd like to see them all do that because it would save us all a lot of money, because if not, they'll go on to Medicaid most likely.
Right.
Or they'll continue to have to work.
Right.
To make a mortgage payment. And that's tough to do as a senior. So we're seeing a lot of that take place. We know it's out there. We need people to educate their friends and family who are on this radio, listen to the radio show. Have them give me a call or go on to the HUD website, www.hud.com, HUD.gov, excuse me, and search HECM, H-E-C-M. That'll give them all the information for the purchase program and also just for the refi program, because we're running into a lot of people who don't want to move now. Right. They have an existing mortgage and they call themselves retired. Well, they're still working a part-time job and it's hard. So we're seeing a lot of them with enough equity, about 60% equity, be able to knock out the existing mortgage and not have to make a payment again. So it's cash flowing back in their pocket.
Well, and in those situations, I know a lot of the pushback, and you and I have talked about it, and you know, as part of part of my board exams, the CFP board exam, is to learn what, you know, the HECM actually is and how that works. But a lot of people hearken back to the old reverse mortgage, and they think back, okay, well, that's that. Once you do that, then I'm giving up. I don't own the house anymore, and my kids don't get anything, because that's, you know, for a lot of folks, that's their estate plan, right? That's the estate they want to leave to their kids, because they don't have a lot of, they're living off Social Security and PERS maybe, or mm-hmm. or Social Security and a pension, mm-hmm. and that has no residual benefit at the end, either Social Security or the pension. And so their legacy that they're leaving is their home.
Right. Which makes sense. I think that's a great plan, but they also have to plan for a medical event. They also have to plan for potential nursing care facility payments. And those are expensive. So how do you do that right? Well, with the new program, they've set it up so you can try to age in place and have in-home care, which is far less expensive. Have somebody come and take care of you in your home. And that makes your life and your lifestyle a lot better, plus your cash flow. The other thing we're seeing is that as people are starting to take advantage of this program and learning more about it, they see that they keep title to their home. It's just a lien from FHA against the home. So it goes to their children upon death, or if they sell it, they can sell it without having to pay any penalty. So there's flexibility, and it gives them the opportunity to have the cash flow again, because that's critical. In retirement, as the CFP and all of our CPAs know, retirement income is getting pretty stable. We don't see an increase in Social Security income. And so that boa constrictor of retirement continues to just mm-hmm. squeeze tighter and tighter.
Right.
And it's
harder
for people to plan.
I liken it to, you know, to money being, you know, people say money is math, right? But I think it's more like an orange. You know, I've used that analogy before, because if you put an orange out on your counter and you leave it there, it just continues to shrink, right?
Right.
So there's less orange, and that's, you know, inflation, the way that inflation goes for folks, if they're on a pension or a fixed income that's not increasing, once you turn on your PERS, once you turn on your Social Security, They did increase Social Security, you know, for cost of living, and they do that occasionally, but they don't always, and you can't necessarily count on it.
Right.
But like we talked about, a lot of times it's not enough cash flow. And if you can't pay for nursing care or things like that, then you're going to not have a legacy to leave behind either.
Right.
But the big key, I think, that really speaks to me about the possibility, again, the big caveat that we always put in here is this not a blanket statement to it's not for everybody, just information out there for this may make sense for your situation. If you think it might, give us a call, you know, give Michael a call and talk to him about it. He's not going to tell you it fits for you if it doesn't fit for you. And then even if he did, HUD wouldn't tell you if it fits for you if it doesn't fit for you. But the big concern that people have is giving up that equity in the house. And if you're utilizing the program right, there is residual legacy still left for your kids, in addition to the cash part of it that we were just talking about, not depleting your retirement assets or your cash assets, but there's still equity in the house that's there. It's not like the old program where you basically gave up title and the bank owned it, and then, you know, then the kids could be underwater and owe money on it. All those things have been
correct. All those have been cured, and now it's an FHA insured loan. So even if the house, when you pass it to your heirs, if the debt is higher or the lien's higher than the value of the home at the time, the FHA insurance steps in, so the kids don't have to take a loss. They don't have to file bankruptcy. So that saves the kids any hardship. But the key is cash flow. And that's why we're here on an investment show. It's all about cash flow. It's what did you do with your investments? How are you planning for that? And this is just another planning tool to use your equity, use the cash in your walls as part of your retirement so you don't run out of money in retirement, because that's horrible to outlive your money. We want to see people use this tool because it gives them the flexibility to have opportunities in their lives. Do something fun. One of the clients I just dealt with or working with this past week, person is not, spouse is not doing well health-wise, and they want to keep the spouse in the home, but they can't afford to continue, they can't continue to work, and they can't afford to make their mortgage payments and live the life they need to live. So this is a great tool for them to use their equity, all those payments.
Right.
Knock out the existing mortgage. Now they have $1,100 cash flow back into their budget because they don't have to make a mortgage payment and they can live in the house until they pass. Gives them the opportunity to enjoy life and not be so stressed.
Right. That's a big thing. You know, I know that doing retirement planning with clients, their big goal for a lot of people is to have the mortgage paid off mm-hmm. by the time that they retire. And it's not necessarily for the ownership portion of it, it's for the cash flow portion of it.
Right.
It's because I don't want to have an $1,100, $1,800, $2,000 payment a month once I retire, because that's, you know, think about how the power of that $1,100 if you still have it, but like you said, utilizing the HECM as a way to pay off the mortgage and have better cash flow. But you could take that $1,100 that you were putting towards the mortgage and put it towards something else, towards building up that legacy account if you want to leave it behind to the kids, to saving, you know, throwing money into a college savings plan for your grandkids,
right.
Whatever that may be.
Purchasing long-term care insurance if possible.
Right.
To really insure your estate from loss. The thing we're seeing now is I just want people to understand that it is a new program. And it's not as scary as it used to be. It's not right for everybody, but everybody should do some research and figure out if it's part of their financial plan, because we want them to use their equity to make their lives a little bit better.
Right. I mean, it's as much as we can, just like you said, make their lives better. The other question that I had that came in actually last time you were on the show and came in after the show, but was that when you use it as an, you know, you have your investors, these real estate investors that are using this as a you know, cash bumper because the credit line grows at an interest rate. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
You bet. You do have two portions, two sides of the equation. You've got the loan side, and you've got the line of credit side. So if you have equity in the line of credit that's yours, that's growing at the same rate as the loan. So right now, 3.89% essentially is what the line of credit is growing at as well. And CFPs are talking to their clients about if they're going to stay in the home, set up the line of credit and use that as your buffer in the future as part of your long-term care planning. Because if your $300,000 of equity in your home is growing at 3, 4, 5, 6%, up to 8%, that's good money. It's a good opportunity to just let that grow and use it as you need it, because it comes out tax-free as well.
Right. And if you don't use it, then it
goes back to the kids.
Right. No harm, no foul.
Right.
The equity is still there because it's ostensibly for lack of a better term, but just to simplify, because I know this is oversimplification, but this is investing, simplify the show, right? But so oversimplify it, it's like a HELOC, but you don't have to qualify with the income and the other thing. So it's a line of credit on your house, but utilizing the HECM program.
Correct. Then it can't be canceled either, which we saw a lot of that happen 2008 through 2010.
Right.
A lot of the banks had to call on those HELOCs. Also, the benefit is you don't have to pay it back. So for people who need cash flow, that's important. Very important. And for us, the sandwich generation, whose parents are in that point of their life where maybe they need to do some planning, that's probably something to talk with your parents about, because we want your parents and you want your parents to have a good life towards the end, not feel stressed and have to make decisions that aren't going to be fun. So set it up early. Use it as necessary. If it's the right tool for you, it'll be obvious. If it's not, there's other options too.
Right. It'll be obvious as well, yeah. Right? So with that, we're going to take our last break here. If you have a question that we haven't covered, you have a question for Michael about the HECM program or about mortgages that are out there, refis, taxes for Kevin, investments or planning for me, give us a call, 503-417-9595. Otherwise, we'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
It's Michael Standard, Regional Reverse Mortgage Specialist and Senior Mortgage Banker with Fairway's First Team Independent Mortgage Corporation. For more information on home equity conversion mortgages and traditional mortgages, please call me at 360-690-5278. Again, 360-690-5278 for a free consultation, or email me at michael.standard@fairwaymc.com. NMLS number 1674259.
Copyright 2019. Fairway Independent Mortgage Corporation. Fairway. NMLS number 2289. 4750 South Biltmore Lane. Madison, Wisconsin 53718. 1-866-912-4800. All rights reserved. Fairway is not affiliated with any government agencies. These materials are not from HUD or FHA and were not approved by HUD or a government agency. Reverse mortgage borrowers are required to obtain an eligibility certificate by receiving counseling sessions with a HUD-approved agency. The youngest borrower must be at least 62 years old. Monthly reverse mortgage advances may affect eligibility for some other programs. This is not an offer to enter into an agreement. Not all customers will qualify. Information, rates, and programs are subject to change without notice. All products are subject to credit and property approval. Other restrictions and limitations apply. Michael Standards, Oregon and Washington, NMLS number 1674259.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. Thanks for listening today. Thanks for sticking with us. We've been talking mortgage rates and interest rates. We've been talking taxes. And Kevin, we have a question on the line. Looks like Mark has a question for you. I would assume it involves taxes. Hello, Mark.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for asking. How about yourself?
Good. Going to the Oregon State game.
Oh, nice, nice. That's at 12:30, right? Go Beavs.
1:15, ready to leave about 15 minutes.
Okay. Well, let's get your question answered so we can get you on the road so you don't get stuck in that traffic.
Yeah, well, that angel thing, what is it? Anyway, Woodburn's going on, too.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, the question is, my mother left a trust for us. There was about $4 million, and it was four houses. We recently sold the last house, and when she died, it was worth $234,000, and there's three of us involved in the trust, my brothers and I. We sold it for $157,000 with a net of $149,000. Do we get to write that difference off on our taxes?
You're saying, well, real quick, this is a living trust?
She passed away, so it's revoked.
Okay, so but it was a living trust. These weren't like a credit shelter from a prior. Okay,
no.
So the house would get a step up basis when she passed away. All of her assets get stepped up to fair market value on the date of death. So that's your baseline for your basis. Any gain above that, the beneficiaries would pay tax on.
But if you had a loss. Yeah, so it sounds like the fair market value, and just make sure I understood, Mark, was four and change, and we sold it for 150 net.
Gotcha.
Right?
So a loss would get passed out as a capital loss to the beneficiaries.
And it's divided three ways?
Exactly right.
Yep. Okay.
Yep.
All right. Another question I had, my mother left us each about $500,000 in stocks. Now, if I was to sell those, I only pay capital gains on what she paid for them. Is that correct?
You would pay, same scenario as the house, you would pay tax on the difference from the value at date of death of those stocks and compared to what you sold them for, gain or loss.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, great.
Yep.
All right. Thank you for your answer.
Absolutely. If the estate sells them, then they would get passed out through the estate return via a K-1 to you. If you inherited the stocks directly into your own brokerage account and sold them, then it's just directly on your own tax return. And you'll want to work with your broker to make sure that the 1099s report the correct basis, and they should adjust the basis on those 1099 forms to the date of death value.
Now, my mother left me a third of two homes, and then she gave each of my brothers a home. Are they taxed on that? And I see. It's the same thing. It's only taxed on what it was valued at when she passed.
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it. It's kind of a big puzzle, but we got to put all the pieces together.
It is exactly right. And, of course, you're talking income taxes at a $4 million estate, whether it's Oregon or Washington. Sounds like there was probably some estate taxes that needed to be paid.
How about $350,000 and the state sent us back $15,000?
Okay. Well, someone's working. That sounds like about right. Sounds like
yeah. Well, I got a brother-in-law I think you work for, so you know who that guy is. He lives in Sandy.
Oh, okay. Well,
yeah.
Okay, very good.
Thanks, Mark. Great question. That's a good question that comes up a lot. That the big thing is that basis step up, right? So we talk about leaving money to yours, leaving investable securities or property, and a lot of times the question is, do we gift them during life or do we gift them after death, right? And we can talk. We've talked with Taylor when she's in about setting up that credit shelter trust or to avoid the estate tax. But a lot of times that can make a lot of sense. In this situation for Mark, it sounds like it makes a ton of sense, right? So had a revocable living trust. Now the kids inherit the property and the stocks. And if they were super worried about the estate tax, which he mentioned was a pretty high bill, right? Pretty sizable bill because it's about $4 million estate. But if she had instead gifted those stocks during her lifetime or gifted that property, that basis goes with it. So that's a big difference, right? So in Mark's situation, he might be making more money than the 10% estate tax rate, right? So if he's got a capital gain, so if hypothetically those stocks that mom bought, she maybe bought them 30 years ago, right? She probably was a savvy investor, bought these stocks a while ago. There could be $1 million of gain that you're then having at your capital gains rate, even if it's only 15%, but at that point it wouldn't be, right? Because you're making so much money.
Right.
But so you're paying significant, 20% plus your income tax rates are way sky high
on everything
as opposed to just a 10% estate tax.
That's right. People really, are scared of the estate tax, but we're talking roughly 10, 12% versus possibly... now that's on your total estate, it's a different calculation, 10, 12% of your total estate versus, maybe 15 federal, 9 Oregon, 24% on income taxes. So you really want to plan any gifting versus, keeping an asset in the estate and paying the estate tax, but getting the stepped up basis. It's a joke. There's a lot of opportunity for planning and, there's many different ways to really reduce some significant taxes.
Right. Well, that's I feel like we end every show with a great question that has a reason to talk to a professional, right? So working with your team of professionals to help make sure that you have planned for these different tax rates, planned for the different opportunities, and make sure you're taking full advantage. Michael, if people want to plan for their real estate opportunities with you, how do they get a hold of you?
360-690-5278.
And Kevin, if they need to plan for their estate tax or talk about the difference between gifting during life and paying income tax, how do they talk to you?
We are at baker-colson.com. Our phone number is 503-666-5569.
Perfect. And if you have any other questions about your investments, about your retirement planning, about planning for spending in retirement, and you want me to work hand in hand with Michael and Kevin, give me a call, 503-253-3000. Chuck and I are happy to meet you either east side or west side of town. Also visit pfgwm.com. Thank you for listening to Investing Simplified. We'll see you next week.
Price Financial Group, Wealth Management.
Navigating through today's financial investment world can seem pretty scary. Now, here's the good news. Chuck Price, president of Price Financial Group Wealth Management, introduces a new revolutionary concept that will change how you invest now and in the future. It's called Asset Lock. Asset Lock monitors your investment accounts 24/7, 365 and alerts you when action needs to be taken. And now, Chuck Price offers Asset Lock. At Price Financial Group Wealth Management, we believe all our clients deserve to have Asset Lock monitoring their accounts. So call Chuck today or online at pfgwm.com and learn how you can get Asset Lock on your accounts today for free. Price Financial Group Wealth Management, because the smart investor knows what you don't know can hurt you.
Simplify.
Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. You can listen to past shows of Investing Simplified or sign up for our free newsletter at www.pfgwm.com. This show was brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103, Portland, Oregon, 97216, 503-253-3000 or 877-50-PRICE. Investing Simplified is a registered trademark owned by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated.